From UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation, this is Tales from the South.
This understanding, this living that comes after, this return from places that happy children never visit, is a journey that made everything that was ever wrong with me in the eyes of the world right in the eyes of my own soul.
Recorded in front of a live audience every Tuesday night during dinner at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas.
But on the night of the Jesus moon, when her eyes were shiny with remembering, Grandma told me something she never would have told had her mind and not her heart done the talking.
Sit back, relax, and let's reconnect with the power of a story.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Bonnie Montgomery? Y'all like Bonnie? Bonnie Montgomery is a native Arkansan who is a classically trained opera singer by day and a honky-tonk queen by night. She just finished an international tour with her new three-song EP, Cruel. She is also known as composer of the modern opera, Billy Blythe, about Bill Clinton's youth in Hot Springs, Arkansas. Bonnie has EPs for sale after the show, and more can be heard at BonnieMontgomeryMusic.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to a very special edition of Tales from the South, our Season 7 finale show, where Southerners bring their own true best stories of the year to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and tonight's show and prizes are sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library, all right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 national resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark was a house guitarist at the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? These genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some winning Southern-style storytelling? This week, we bring you our top six stories from Season 7, our two grand prize winners, and our four runners-up. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Jill Duvall's life is forever changed by a stranger. Angela Gatton tries to find her way in a world that threatens to overcome her. Jimmy Meese Mumaw's trip to the beauty shop results in a standoff. Patrice Melnick is judged before she even realizes what is happening, and Janet Smith Post flies away on her grandmother's memories. But let's start the night with J.W. Taylor as his best friend is captured, and J.W. has to make a decision in Izod.
It was a Monday in early spring, and I was in fourth grade. Mom took me to school early, and that meant free recess. Kids took to the playground without supervision. It was like Lord of the Flies without the conch or the futile attempt at establishing democratic governance. The weak cowered, the strong prowled. I expected to find my best friend, Jason Taylor, holding court by the fourth grade fence and sharing the carnal knowledge that we'd stumbled upon Saturday at his house. But when I arrived, he was in the middle of a crowd, and he was turning purple. John Dunn had my friend, and I had a decision to make. I didn't know what had happened, didn't know why or how Jason had been caught. All I knew was that John Dunn had him in a headlock, had both of Jason's feet off the ground, and I could watch or I could do something. It all happened at Trinity Episcopal Day School, a private school in Pine Bluff, Arkansas. Trinity was an L-shaped cinder block building adjacent to its namesake church and separated from it by an 8-foot wrought iron fence covered in honeysuckle. The fence served as more than a barrier, however. Everything the church was, the school wasn't. The church was regal, stately, with tended gardens. The school was squat and low, its asphalt playground filled with steel gym equipment of the sort that one might climb up with 10 fingers and climb down with 8. If architecture proclaims mission, the mission of the church, with its stained glass windows and high spires keeping watch over downtown, was to inspire and awe and symbolize the greatness of God. The architecture of the school suggested that its mission was to turn out good little Soviets. But it was mine. It was my school, my teachers, my friends. Jason Taylor and I had to be best friends because we were Jason Taylors, and Jason Taylors stuck together. Our teachers tried various ways to differentiate us. For a while, I was big Jason and he was little Jason. I liked that one more than he did. Then it was Jason Lee and Jason Wayne. I didn't like that one. Only Mama called me Jason Wayne, and only when I was in trouble. But finally, in fourth grade, Mrs. Rhodes settled on JW and Jason, and that suited us fine. Now, fourth grade was a watershed, a kind of graduation. No longer were we lumped into activities and programs with first, second, and third graders and their tinker toys and share alike nonsense. No, we were men. It was time to put away childish things and focus on what mattered in life. Avoiding sixth graders. And of all the sixth graders, there was one in particular, John Dunn. That's D-U-N-N Dunn. And no, he wasn't an island. He was more of an isthmus, or a peninsula, or perhaps an archipelago. He was huge, and he was mean. John Dunn destroyed anything he could get his hands on. He ripped the head off of Jody Dildy's Stretch Armstrong, squeezed every drop of pink goo out of its neck, and gave the desiccated husk back to Jody. Any loose ball that came his way on the playground was thrown onto the school roof. His basic approach was that anything he touched was his, and he'd do whatever he wanted with it. Yet he never went in search of prey. He was too big for that, and too slow. He was spider-like, waiting for that moment when an overconfident or inattentive fourth or fifth grader stumbled into his web, and then he would strike, tossing kids half his size around like rag dolls, and we were all half his size. When Laura Kate Jones didn't show back to school after one Christmas break, it was rumored that John Dunn had eaten her. And even when Mrs. Pay told us that Laura Kate had moved to Kansas City, she had no proof, and we believed what we believed. The Friday before that fateful Monday in early spring, I stayed the night at Jason's house, and we spent all of Saturday playing in the concrete drainage ditch that ran behind his house. We caught frogs and turtles, threw rocks at broken bottles, and threw rocks at one another. It was in this drainage ditch that we found a water-soaked and bloated Playboy magazine. Now, for a fourth-grade boy, finding a girly magazine in any condition was better than coming home to find a leprechaun riding a unicorn in your backyard. We were spellbound. We studied our text with all the care and attention of a scholar getting her first look at a Gutenberg Bible. Up until that point, we had assumed that a woman took her clothes off for the same reason a man did, for a bath. Yet there on the page, right in front of us, a woman was not only unashamedly naked, but apparently thought it entirely appropriate, preferable even, to be naked while changing the spark plugs in her Corvette Stingray. We couldn't wait for Monday morning. We had been gifted forbidden knowledge, and it was our duty to share it with our friends. When that Monday finally arrived, I wore my green Izod. It was the best shirt I had. In fact, it was the first piece of clothing I owned that was both made and worn during the same administration. I spent the Carter years in LBJ hand-me-downs. But now Reagan was president, and I had a green Izod. It was morning in America. Mom dropped me at school. I put my things in the classroom and headed to the playground. I saw the crowd, some shouting encouragement to Jason, some laughing at him. I saw Jason flailing and kicking, clawing at the arms around his neck and trying to break free. And I saw John Dunn. He was smiling. It was a smile that did it. I was at full speed when I left, and John Dunn must have caught sight of me because he dropped Jason and turned to face me, but it was too late. I caught him in the chest with my shoulder. I heard his breath leave him. As he fell to the ground, he grabbed my collar and ripped my green Izod in half. I stood over him quiet. As he tried to find his breath, I struck him hard. His nose ran red, and he cried. He hounded me the rest of the year. It didn't matter. I had beaten him. He had hurt my friend, and I hurt him back. These days, he'd have excuses. Broken home, glands, too much television. But back then, he was just mean and got what was coming. Because right was right, and wrong was wrong. Well, right is right, wrong is wrong. And I'd still trade an Izod for a best friend any day.
J.W. Taylor is an Arkansas native living in Little Rock with his wife, Jennifer, and daughters, Elizabeth and Catherine. He skipped writing his first and second novels and is currently working on not writing his third. In our next story, Jill Duvall goes to help someone and the tables turn in All of It.
When the referral came in, the nurse said they had an AIDS patient who was dying all alone and probably would only live a few more days. His name was Robert something, a 42-year-old black male. On the first two visits, Robert stayed quiet. Occasionally, I would say something nice to him like, "I'm so sorry you're sick," or "I know it's weird having a stranger in your room." Robert would open his eyes after I spoke, but he never said a word. On the third visit, Robert spoke to me for the first time. "What kind of female are you?" "What do you mean?" I ask. "I mean, what kind of person would come to my room like this?" I could see his point. It was depressing as all hell. What kind of fool would come and sit with a stranger who's dying and sit in quiet for hours? "Well," I said, "it is my job. I do like to meet people, and you don't seem too bad so far." I laughed because although I felt I knew him, he'd never shared anything with me. "Tell me who you are," he said. Now, in the professional world of medicine and psychology, one does not tell one's personal information to a client or patient. But when a dying man asked me a simple question, I couldn't think of a reason not to answer. "I'm 26 years old, from Arkansas. I have naturally curly hair. I love to play tennis. I have two brothers and a mom and a dad. I just got my master's last year. I'm in a serious relationship, but not married yet. How about you?" Robert chuckled. "I don't think you want to hear my story. It don't sound as good." "Oh, I've heard it all," I said. "There's nothing you can say that will upset me." He laughed again. "Oh, yeah?" He went on to tell me that he didn't feel right telling me his story, given his situation. "What situation is that?" I asked. "With this problem I have," he said, "the AIDS." I was used to this part. All my clients felt guilty for having AIDS, felt embarrassed, almost like they were embarrassed to be dying so young, like if they were better people, they could live longer. I waited a second and then spoke. Illness strikes good people and bad people, Robert. Viruses don't take a personal moral inventory before they infect you. Just like mosquitoes, if you're human, you can get bit. Robert smiled and reached for my hand. Did you come to see me because I'm going to die or because I have AIDS? I came because it seemed like you needed a visitor. Everyone needs a visitor when they're sick. This satisfied him for the day. He closed his eyes and fell asleep. I kept holding his hand until I had to go. Over the next few days, Robert told me his story. He was born in the sand hills of North Carolina, had dropped out of high school, joined the Army, and was sent to Vietnam. He said in his first few weeks there, he was given heroin to help him cope with the job. He said the officers passed it out like candy. Once home from the war, he became a truck driver, crisscrossing the United States. One day, I brought up the subject of race. In graduate school, I was trained to be honest and open about race. I was told to state the obvious, that I was white and he was black. Robert was so serious when I brought it up. My supervisor wants me to see if my being white with you being black is causing problems for you. Robert asked if he defended me somehow, causing me to ask him this question. This was hilarious to me to think he would offend me when it was far more likely that I would offend him. He also told me that he didn't care if I was white because I couldn't help the way that I was born. Over the next 3 weeks, I went to visit him every day, and a deep friendship grew between us. I would kiss his cheek on my way out of the room, and he would bow his head and slightly turn his cheek away. It became clear he was not going to die and would be discharged home. I remember him saying he never expected us to be friends, and I agreed. We had absolutely nothing in common. He was in his 40s, black, a former IV drug user, a truck-driving Vietnam vet. I was a college-educated white girl who thought hard times were student loans. But we were the same. About a year later, I got a call from Robert at the office. He was driving through town and wanted to say hello. We agreed to meet at the Starvin' Marvin gas station just off of I-40. I was excited to see him. On the way over, I realized that I'd never seen him in street clothes or behind the wheel of a car. And although I felt a bond with him, I wasn't sure I'd recognize him. I got there first and waited. An older Cadillac pulled onto the road in front of the station. Sitting in the driver's seat was a black man scanning the parking lot. I saw fuzzy dice hanging from his rearview mirror. On his left hand on the steering wheel, I noticed several gold rings sparkling in the lunchtime sun. Robert parked a few cars down from me. As I got out of my car, I saw Robert's sweet face down the row. He was much heavier, dressed up fancy. He had on a purple dress shirt and brown dress pants. His sleeves were rolled up halfway due to the heat of the summer day. I started towards him, but as I approached him, I noticed a row of white construction workers sitting on their tailgates watching us. It occurred to me for the first time, in a flash of a moment, I was not supposed to hug him. I was shocked to think this and looked at him, and what was even more shocking is that he said, "You don't have to hug me if you don't want to." In that moment, I realized that he had seen those white construction workers like I had, knew the racial norms better than I, and was prepared to give me an out. I knew I wasn't supposed to hug him. I was afraid one of us or both of us would be attacked. "You've got to be kidding," I said, and hugged his neck long and hard. We moved to his car and held hands and talked for an hour. But I felt sick to my stomach the whole time we were talking. It was not the white construction workers that made me sick, or Robert's rings and his fuzzy dice. It was not the AIDS crisis and all the people dying. It was not my mama's childhood fear of black men, or my daddy's silence as his black teammates ate their dinners in back kitchens. It wasn't that I knew I would have been afraid of Robert if I'd seen him in another setting, and it wasn't because I loved him. It was all of it.
Jill Duvall lives in Russellville, Arkansas, and tries to write every day. She recently published a mystery ebook, Premeditated Blues, and is busy working on the second installment. Next, Angela Gatton tries to hang on in her grand prize winning story, Soft Landing.
I was 10 years old as I sat on the floor beside my great-grandmother's easy chair with our eyes fixed on the hulking console television set. It felt like we were right there on the lawn beside the tarmac at Kennedy Space Center in Cape Canaveral, Florida, instead of a small town in northern Kentucky watching the space shuttle land. My eyes boggled as the astronaut stepped out of the shuttle, bent down, and kissed the ground. I turned to my great-grandmother. "Why did he do that?" I asked, as the crowd on the TV cheered and the voices of the broadcasters swelled with pride. She looked at me with crinkly eyes and her trademark toothless grin. "He's kissing the Earth because he's so happy to get home safely." The next day at recess, I walked out onto the black asphalt of the small playground. There were two playgrounds, a small one for grades 1 through 3, and a much larger one for grades 4 through 6. I was in the fourth grade, but I couldn't play on the big playground because I was bullied so badly. Every day I took my recess on the small playground alone. I always had the swing and the entire playground all to myself. I was the outcast, the kid everybody hated and teased incessantly until I retreated to the small playground. In the fourth grade, the worst possible thing you could be was poor. The second worst was poor and smart. I was both, so I got double helpings of abuse for not having the decency to be poor and stupid. I ate lunch with the teacher every day because no one wanted to sit with me. No one would be my partner for projects. When we had to learn square dancing, I had to dance with the teacher. Even the kids who sympathized me were too afraid to be friends with me for fear of being cast out along with me. There was nothing I could wear, do, or say that didn't become fodder for the bullies. They made fun of my clothes and shoes. They made fun of my hair, my laugh, things I said, and the way I ate. They even made fun of the way I sat in my chair. It never stopped. The bus stop, the bus, the classroom, the cafeteria, the playground, they were all venues for reinforcement that I was unacceptable. In gym class, they mocked me even when I was good. They put stuff in my food, they stole from me, they destroyed my projects, they called me names. The most popular taunt was Angie Stinks. The minute I would walk into class in the morning, the collective groaning would begin and I would be heckled all the way to my seat. If I signed up for an activity, they would cross my name off the sign-up sheet. When the teacher left the room, they threw things at me. If I cried, they made fun of me. If I laughed, they made fun of me. If I tried to make friends with them, they made fun of me. If I tried to withdraw and isolate myself, they would eventually get bored and come find me. If someone defended me or a new kid befriended me, that unfortunate kid would get the same treatment. This carried over every grade, one after the other, for 12 years. The taunting was ultimately effective in that I hated myself for being so hated, for the inability to do anything to improve my situation from one day to the next. I couldn't understand why no one could accept me, but I also never felt that there was anything I could do about it. I was hated for natural things, for things I couldn't change, for simply being alive. I learned to cope with the bullying, but not the self-loathing. I couldn't make myself good enough to be accepted. It just didn't work. I still had to wake up every day a social leper, and eventually, I hated myself more than anyone else hated me. Recess on the small playground became the only peace I could get. I didn't even bother with the big playground. When the entire class ran right to the big playground, I automatically walked left to the empty playground around the corner where no one could see me and I could be left alone. The teacher would try to force me back to the big playground, but I always snuck away and eventually even she left me alone to swing. The day after watching the space shuttle land, as I made my way across the small playground, I wondered what it would be like to kiss the ground as the astronaut had done. I walked over and sat on my usual swing, which was very low to the ground. I leaned over as if I were looking at something on the ground and then puckered up and kissed it, pretending I was an astronaut and had just gotten back. I instantly regretted it as a bajillion tiny pebbles and sand from under the swing stuck to my mouth. It was awful. As I swiped at my mouth with the back of my hand, the tiny pebbles scraped against my lips and cheeks. The astronaut had smiled and waved to the cameras when he stood up, but I was spitting and slobbering and sanding a layer of skin away, trying to get the grit off of my face. 25 years later, I sat in the corner of the office lunchroom and silently absorbed the news of a co-worker's suicide, while around me, women ranted and screeched about not being able to understand it. They bellowed long and hard about families left behind and stupidity and selfishness and religious implications. As each one got it out of her system, she walked away wringing her hands, finishing it off with more, "I just don't understand." I understood perfectly. The understanding earned on the small playground produced a profound silence in me, not a screaming fit. It made me retreat to a cold bench in the courtyard and remember the dull ache of negative reinforcement that slowly grows into exactly the thing that confounded these women. I felt grateful to understand what other people couldn't, that I had been close to what many people will never know, and backed away, one breath at a time, over the course of an entire life. It made me feel kindred to the departed fellow, even though we were never friends. I couldn't bully his memory. I could only whisper to him, "I understand." This understanding, this living that comes after, this return from places that happy children never visit, is a journey that made everything that was ever wrong with me in the eyes of the world right in the eyes of my own soul. From the courtyard where the homeless sometimes napped, I saw dandelions growing out from under concrete. Suddenly, I wanted to find a small playground and sit in a low-slung swing. I wouldn't cry because I was alone and hiding yet again. I would cry because my life is so beautiful now that it won't fit inside me anymore, and I am alive to write about it. Once again, I would bend to kiss the surface of a planet that was once so hard to live upon, this time grateful that I had finally made it home safely. Then I would smile and wave to the cheering crowds as the voices of the broadcasters swelled with pride.
Angela Gatton grew up in Kentucky and moved to Central Arkansas 5 years ago. Angela is employed by a nonprofit organization in Benton, Arkansas, and describes her freelance writing occupation as language artist. In our next story, Jimmy Meese Mumaw goes to do something on her own without her mama in Hot Perm.
I was 8 years old with my head full of rollers as I followed the oldest May sister toward a machine in the back room of the May sister's beauty parlor. A machine that looked like a cross between the electric chair and a torture machine that I had seen in Saturday movie serials where a half-man, half-lizard monster captured his victims to be guinea pigs for his mad master's scientific experiments. It also looked a little bit like an octopus, only the tentacles were big, thick electric wires like the cords on Mama's iron. It was a machine that took my breath away. After years of trying and failing to make my hair curly like Shirley Temple's, Mama had decided it was time for me to get a hot perm. Now understand, getting a hot perm 60 years ago involved rolling your hair around big old heavy metal rollers and then taking some thingamabobs that looked like big iron clothespins that were hanging down on electric wires and hooking them up over the rollers and turning on the current. Now, not realizing that I was in store for a near-death experience, I had assured my mama that I was a big girl, and she didn't have to walk me to the beauty parlor and wait for me. I could do it all by myself. Boy, was I wrong. You see, my hair was a problem from the day I was born. I was born bald-headed and stayed that way until I was almost 2 years old and had long legs and knobby knees. When I did finally get a little bit of hair, it was straight and fine as silk. Bless her heart, though, Mama was determined that her baby was going to have curly hair, even if she had to glue it in place. So when I was about 4 or 5 years old, she started rolling my hair every Saturday night in something she called Dipsy Doodle curlers, which were pieces of leather with a slit in one end to pull the other end through. Somehow, Mama managed to wrap those things around the fuzz on my head and twist and pull it hard enough to make my eyes water. Well, when I got a little older, Mama decided that I needed to have a more permanent solution and started giving me home perms. Now, understand, back then, home perms were nowhere near being an exact science. Mama bought the ones that were supposed to make soft waves in hair. But there was no way on earth to make soft waves in my thin, limp fuzz. So the perms Mama gave me ended up making my hair so dried out and curly that I just wound up with a tangled mass of fried, kinky curls. Mama's home waves also had a way of turning my hair orange. So she finally gave up and decided to stop torturing me herself and send me to a real beauty parlor to let a professional do it for her. That's when she decided I needed to go see the May sisters. All the May sisters were old maids. The really plain, homely kind of old maids with straight, bowl-cut hair, utterly devoid of style. I always thought it was strange that they spent most of their lives making other women look pretty, while they apparently gave absolutely no thought to how they looked. But they were the ones in Brookhaven that you called when your loved ones went to the funeral home. They were the ones that went there to powder and paint them up. So naturally, that was where everybody in Brookhaven went to get their hair done. I'd walk myself there, ready for my hot perm. Now, I sat through the rolling part without a problem, chatting with the oldest May sister about their mayhaw trees. When she finished yanking me around and rolling me, she motioned for me to follow her and started walking toward the back. And that's when I began to imagine just how hot a hot perm might be. And that's when I balked. I could tell that the oldest May sister had no sense of humor. And as it turned out, she had no patience whatsoever with recalcitrant children. So when I balked, the oldest May sister smiled at me condescendingly and decided she'd just pull me over to the chair. Well, when she grabbed my arm, I sat down, dragged my rubber-heeled shoes across her shiny floor, and declined to be electrocuted as politely as I could under the circumstances. Normally, I would have been embarrassed about causing such a commotion in public, but this time, I really didn't care. I knew that resisting an adult, especially one you weren't related to, was impolite, possibly even illegal. But I really did not want that woman hooking me up to that machine. Under the scrutiny of all of her customers, the oldest May sisters changed tactics. She let go of my arm and tried to reason with me by assuring me that her customer hot perm survival rate was 100%. I didn't move. She offered me some hard candy as a bribe and tried to embarrass me by suggesting I was just a big old baby, but I wouldn't get up. It was clear that we were at an impasse. I had her rollers in my hair, and she was determined that, by God, she is going to finish her job. I was equally determined not to let her electrocute me without my mama. So I suggested a compromise. I told her I would sit under her machine if she would let me go home and get my mama. And she agreed. Now, even as good a pro as the oldest May sister was, it had taken her a long time to twist my soft hair around those iron rods, and she wasn't about to take the curlers down and start all over again. She made me lead the rods in, and she put a great big old hair net over my head, and I left the shop and walked down Main Street with my head wobbling and bobbing under the weight of the rollers, and at the same time tried to act as if there was nothing unusual about my appearance. When I passed Miss Ella Lee, our next door neighbor coming out of Janie's bakery, she stared at me. Rather impolitely, I thought. But I just nodded my head and said, "Morning, Ms. Lee." It was, of course, a mistake to try to nod my head, because when I did, it just kind of rolled over on my shoulder. But I just kept on walking. Mama was surprised when she heard me coming back in, and she gasped when she got a good look at me. She couldn't imagine what I was doing back so soon and with permanent paraphernalia all over my head. Well, I started talking real fast, the way I always did when I was trying to tell Mama something embarrassing, incriminating, or worst of all, that I thought might make her nervous. The one thing in my life I could not bear to do was make my Mama nervous. See, Mama's lips were naturally really thin, and when she got nervous, she pinched them really so tight that she didn't have no lips at all. And then she would go in another room and hum sad hymns. Not the pretty hymns they played in church when inviting you to come on down and give your soul to Jesus, but sad hymns, like the old rugged cross, "And I Come to the Garden Alone." Well, I blurted out that I just had a near-death experience. That the oldest May sister had tried to electrocute me. And that I needed her. Really needed her with me. She, of course, agreed that no child should have to risk electrocution at the beauty parlor without her mama. So she took my hand, and we walked back to the shop, my head bobbing and swaying all the way, where the oldest May sister fried my hair to Mama's satisfaction without further delay. That was the only hot perm I ever got, much, I suspect, to the relief of the May sisters.
Jimmy Meese Mumo is a retired professor of communication, writer, popular public speaker, and communication consultant. Current projects include developing her blog, Out on a Limb, and writing a new book on creativity and imagination. Next, Patrice Melnick goes in for an exam and realizes there's more than her eyes being examined in The Ophthalmologist.
I went to an ophthalmologist to be sure that a recent bout with shingles had not damaged my eye. I dutifully filled out the paperwork and checked off boxes regarding medical history. I paused for only a moment as I checked off the HIV box. It was a cold March day in Fairbanks, Alaska, and my parka lay wadded up on the chair beside me as I waited. "This might sting a moment," said the bald-headed, ruddy-faced doctor as he put drops into my eyes. "Not too uncommon for AIDS patients to get shingles." "I am not an AIDS patient," I thought. "I have HIV." In my mind, having HIV meant I had not yet become terminally ill. Shingles was not one of the opportunistic infections. I'd heard of pneumocystis pneumonia or Kaposi's sarcoma, extremely rare diseases. Regular people got shingles. The healthy, portly nurse at the hospital told me that she had shingles once. This meant that normal people got them. I was not different, not yet. It was not an opportunistic infection. Therefore, I did not have AIDS. I needed to believe this. I clung to the HIV definition. AIDS patient meant I belonged in a hospice, needed constant medical care, was in and out of hospitals. AIDS meant it was too late for me. My face was warm, my hands clammy. "I think of myself as having HIV," I said. "Mm-hmm," the doctor nodded. "So you got HIV from a blood transfusion?" he asked. "No." My vision grew blurry from the drops. "Wait just a minute for your eyes to dilate," the doctor said. "So not from a blood transfusion?" "No." I wondered why he asked how I had been infected and why he assumed blood transfusion. Did blood transfusion seem the most likely way in which a woman would become infected? Did he think I seemed like a nice girl and therefore couldn't have gotten HIV from sex or sharing needles? I hoped that he was not trying to figure me into his assessment of guilt or innocence. I did not feel more or less guilty than anyone else. "I'll be right back," the doctor said as he walked out the door. I sat in the blue-gray room until he returned and shut off the lights. He shone a light into each eye. "So, where did you get it from?" His tone was friendly, casual. Perhaps he was just trying to make conversation. "From sex," I said. "Sex with a man." I hoped the questions would end. He projected onto the wall an eye chart. "I think I read most of the letters right." "That's fine," he said as he switched on the lights. I could hear the soft buzz of a flickering light bulb. "Do you know from who?" he asked. I couldn't figure out how to make the doctor stop asking questions without being rude. He seemed nosy, like a man that peers through the midnight bedroom window of his neighbor's house. Was he trying to figure out if I was guilty or a victim? "I got it in the Central African Republic," I said, "in the Peace Corps." I hoped he'd be satisfied. "Not too much scarring," the doctor said as he scribbled something into my chart. "Vision seems fine." "Was it from a white man or a black man?" My stomach tightened into a fist. White or black? Good or bad? My heart raced. I felt like the doctor had shifted me from the blood transfusion victim box into the sex guilt box, and now he was trying to figure out whether to toss me from the sex with white man box into the sex with black man box. Was he trying to imagine scenes as though watching a movie in his mind? Was he trying to figure out if this was Sleepless in Seattle or Jungle Fever? Love Story or Guess Who's Coming to Dinner? When Harry Met Sally or Zebrahead? I wondered who would play me in the love scenes. Not Julia Roberts or Meg Ryan, too glamorous. Maybe Janine Garofalo or Frances McDormand, down to earth. But the doctor was wondering who would play the male lead. Johnny Depp or Denzel Washington? Brad Pitt or Wesley Snipes? John Cusack or Samuel L. Jackson? Would there be full frontal nudity? Surely the obligatory flash of breasts? Would the actress do her own love scenes or have a double? Would there be male frontal nudity, a la Harvey Keitel, the piano? Would nudity harm or help the ratings? Would the production inch into soft porn? The doctor wanted details. He wanted to see the story. People want to see the story. The public wants details, bare flesh. This was no longer a medical situation, a virus, a patient. This was skin. This was racy. This was race. But it was also about the boxes, the innocent victim box versus the got what she deserved box. And I seemed like a nice girl. I was going to graduate school. My clothes were clean, my skin pale. I spoke standard English, and I had a pretty smile in the right light, if you don't look too close. I envisioned some of my African friends. Mariam Hama ran vividly printed meters of fabric between her fingers. Awa's slender, coffee-toned hands braided her sister's hair. The upbeat guitar solos of the Central African band Makembe played in my head. Vocal harmonies sang in my veins. The doctor's blue eyes scanned my face for an answer. "I don't see how this is relevant," I said. "Oh, of course not. Just wondering," the doctor said hastily. "Looks like your vision won't be affected, but if you have any problems, give me a call." I gathered my parka and wool hat. My palms sweated, and I felt dizzy as I hurried towards the door. I stepped out into the ice-sharp Alaskan air, and the snow glare blinded me. I put on my shades and took deep breaths. I began to walk home, crunching over the snow-crusted sidewalk as a syncopated rhythm drummed inside my head.
Patrice Melnick's story, The Ophthalmologist, is from her memoir entitled Po' Boy Contraband from Catalyst Book Press. She lives in Grand Coteau, Louisiana, where she runs a gift shop and directs the Festival of Words. In our final story of the night, Janet Smith Post's grandmother gets lost in a memory and takes Janet along in her grand prize winning story, Moonlight Memory.
That night, the stars hung nearly in our window. And the moon was so bright, Grandma called it a Jesus moon, because the river and the woods glowed with light, like Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration. Our little room filled with silver, and Grandma remembered something. I was only 11, but I could tell by the look on her face, it was a grand memory. It was about Grandpa. It was a spring night when Grandpa died, another Jesus moon night, and snow geese were flying overhead, going north to Squaw Creek, where they landed in a world of 1,000 white wings to recognize their own life mate by the sound of its call and by a secret knowing. They would later fly to the Arctic, where the female would lay her eggs and wouldn't leave her nest until her goslings were hatched. Her mate understood her need and would stand guard beside her. Grandpa would have called that a love watch. He did his share of them. More than once, I saw Grandpa uncap the bottle of little heart pills, put one under Grandma's tongue and watched the gray color of her cheeks. Watched till he could say, "You've come back to Peaches, Abby dear. You'll be okay now." Love watch. Although Grandpa was 78 when he died, we had fully expected Grandma would die first. Mama was afraid Grandma's heart would never carry her through Grandpa's funeral and the long, lonely days that followed. But Grandma's heart proved stronger than we knew. It was her mind that couldn't survive the blow. After Grandpa died, sometimes Grandma would forget what day it was or even the year. The present began to melt away like snowflakes in the river, and Grandma lived in the past with Grandpa. So I was sent each night, a small night nurse on a love watch, crunching down the gravel road to sleep beside Grandma. Her mattress was filled with the downy feathers of snow geese. Sinking into its softness cradled me with the finest kind of hug. We shook it out each morning, I on one side, she on the other, flapping our arms like beginner geese. When it was swollen full of morning air, we carried it back to bed, where it waited, a fat white cloud. Like birds ourselves, we returned, ours a nightly migration of sleep on the wings of faithful birds. On summer nights, we'd hear whippoorwills and katydids through the open windows, but it was winter now. Sleep hung heavy in the dark, and the room was still, except our breath, rising, falling, like the wings on which we slept. Sleep requires letting go of earth. Not hard for me, sleeping free with the dreams of an 11-year-old, dreaming perhaps of floating in the clear pool below Hackney Mill Dam, the water a gentle cushion, like the feather bed beneath me. But for Grandma, sleep meant letting go of grief, while she, warm within the feathers, thought of the locked and frozen ground where her mind lay buried with Grandpa. When folks can't sleep, they're given to talk. That's how Grandma came to tell me things, memories drifting like feathers in her snowy head about Grandpa. She remembered how a fire swept the field and he had run to beat the flames and save the house from harm. How he returned, black-faced and worn, wet gunny sacks in hand. He laughed and caught her in his arms to say, "Abby, dear, it's just the smoke that makes me cry. Now put away your tears." And he kissed her till her face was black as his. Other nights, she'd recall how Grandpa never missed the 10 o'clock news. How in his last days, he'd sit there in the rocking chair, his hearing aid lined up with the old Atwater radio so he could catch every word reported on the Korean War. How he loved to tell my Uncle Leonard the merits of his political party. And when it came Uncle Leonard's turn to have a say for the opposing party, Grandpa would point to his hearing aid and say, "I turned her off, Leonard. Can't hear a word." Grandma would laugh and tell me, "Leonard never seemed to consider going first with his argument. I think Leonard was behind the door when the brains got passed out." She'd remember how Grandpa would sing while she played the mandolin. She placed her wedding ring on the hearth while she strummed the strings, and they sang old songs like "Little Blossom" and "I'll Fly Away." But rain had filled the river while they sang, and floodwaters carried the ring away. Then memory's flood would carry her away to the pain that comes with the missing, and she grieved like the geese on which we slept when they have lost a mate. She'd cry and call his name aloud, "Isaac, oh, Isaac." Then, like Mama, I would say, "Now, Grandma, now, remember the story about, or the time when?" I might remind her how Grandpa would start up his old Plymouth coupe just to make certain it could still run. Grandpa would forget to turn on his hearing aid, and he'd rev up the engine louder and louder. By the time he could actually hear that the motor was running, Grandma would be saying, "Grandpa's out there again, going 80 miles an hour in neutral." Stories poured like oil upon the feathers till we were free to float again, free to fluff our lungs with laughter cuddled up to our ears on our feathered cloud. and each morning found our angel prints like those left by children on the snow. But on the night of the Jesus moon, when her eyes were shiny with remembering, Grandma told me something she never would have told had her mind and not her heart done the talking. She looked right past my 11 years into the moonlight and said, "Your grandpa made love to me when he was 77 years old." 77 years mean nothing when you're 11. So it wasn't Grandpa's age that caught my ear. It was the woman pride that filled her voice about her man, that flung my girl dreams to the stars from which the snow geese navigate, that let me see Grandpa flying there some 20,000 feet, honking heartily on his way to some splendid southern shore. I was just a girl gosling, so her words, making love, were only pleasant, empty shapes of sound. But I have come to think that love must be like standing love watch beside another's need. Love must be seeing only one face in a world of fluttering wings and letting go of earth to cushion those we love on faithful wings. And when the river steals our song, love must be to fluff our lungs with laughter till we are free to fly towards some splendid southern shore. Then at last to migrate to that final sleep till all that's left tomorrow is our print upon the snow.
The granddaughter of Ozark grandparents and a native of Missouri, Janet Smith Post now lives in Illinois. Her new novel, Cotton Rock, is set on the White River. More can be found at janetsmithpost.com. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our incredible writers. Thank you to our live audience. And thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company. And our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. Tonight's show and prizes are sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Stitcher, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week on Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.